Super. So you saw I changed the topic a little bit, but as you will see, it is related. Okay. So the whole point of what I'm going to show you, is that solid-state mechanical systems, be it in the form of levitated microspheres, as we have heard already today, or in other forms of LIGO scale, gravitational wave detector mirrors, are actually excellent probes for fundamental physics in tabletop settings. And I pick a specific example because I think it's the most interesting. And using this example, I would like to introduce you to the capabilities of the tabletop sensors that we have these days. Now, I realize it's late, so I promise I try to be as entertaining as possible and keep it at a slow pace. And I also think it's best I just start with the summary. Okay? So basically, here is the summary of what I'm going to tell you. And so once we are through that, then you can decide whether you go asleep and whether you want to continue to hear. Okay, so three main points. Today, there are tabletop experiments, and actually the number is increasing, so from few to many, that actually probe the interface between quantum physics and gravity. They're beautiful experiments. You heard Jason's talk already about atom interferometers and so on, and I will show you a couple of other examples also today. And all these experiments, we also had this discussion already, they can be described by assuming the validity of quantum theory and classical gravity theory. So those two together can describe all experiments that we have today at the interface between quantum physics and gravity. So in a loosely way of speaking, in all these experiments, the quantum system essentially is like a test particle that probes the gravitational environment of classical sources. And up to this date, there is no experiment that would provide us with an answer to the question whether gravity requires a quantum description. We assume it when we want to try to write down the quantum theories of gravity, but we don't have an experiment so far that would actually tell us that we are allowed to do it. Now, on the other hand, this is then where we come to the solid state optomechanical systems. Over the last, more than 15 years, we have seen an incredible progress in the control of massive solid-state objects using quantum techniques, quantum optics and quantum electronics. And I will show you that such systems may actually lead to a new generation of gravitational quantum physics experiments. And with that, what I mean with that is that these would be experiments where the quantum system itself acts as a gravitational source mass. So instead of, like what we have now, having test masses probing external classical fields, we now are in a situation where the quantum system itself generates a gravitational field, acts as a source of gravitational field, and then we can try to probe the phenomenology of gravitational phenomena for a quantum source mass. Okay? The hope is that going in this direction, you will eventually end up with experiments that cannot anymore be described by assuming classical gravity theory and quantum theory. Okay? And the end of our lecture will be to address the experimental challenges that obviously lie in meeting those extremely extreme requirements that we are going to face, and we will go through the numbers to get a feeling for what it would mean to go into an experimental regime of that type. And there's another challenge that is a conceptual one, and here I really hope for continued discussion and the action over the next years with as many people as possible here of you, namely the challenge lies in finding essentially less demanding but similarly meaningful or conclusive tests to address this question. Namely, does gravity require a quantum description? Now, again, given that, so this is the summary of what I'm going to talk about. Now, since it's already late, I thought let's do an historic excursion. Yeah? Namely, these type of questions have actually already been addressed in a completely different context, namely in the context of quantum optics. There has been a huge debate over decades, and we will see almost 7 decades, about the question whether the electromagnetic field, electromagnetic radiation, actually requires a quantum description. You're all aware of the famous 1905 paper of Einstein, concerning a heuristic point of view about the creation and transformation of light, where he formulates the light quantum hypothesis. Just to remind you, in case you haven't read the paper, the argument is a beautiful thermodynamic argument. Einstein analyzes the entropy of radiation inside a closed volume, a box, a volume V0 in that case, and asks the question, how does the entropy of the radiation inside this volume change when I change the volume? And he concludes that the entropy of the change in entropy of the blackbody radiation inside this box scales with Boltzmann constant times the logarithm of the ratio of the two. Okay, and basically, I cannot change that now. Of course, this here has to be U divided by H omega. And this has to be to the power of n. Okay, so this is the expression that he finds for the radiation, for the entropy change in radiation, and he realizes that this is equivalent to the entropy change for an ideal gas if you equate n here with this one, which is the total energy in the system divided by h bar omega, and omega being the frequency of the light. Okay, so he comes to the conclusion by seeing the equivalence of these two expressions that obviously monochromatic radiation, here at low density because it's using only a specific part of the blackbody spectrum, behaves thermodynamically as if it consisted of mutually independent energy quanta of magnitude, here this is now h bar omega divided by n. Okay, so if you you see if your u equals n times h bar omega, you have it, they're equivalent. So with this thermodynamic argument, he concludes now that light behaves like non-interacting particles. This is the origin, this is the argument of the light quantum hypothesis. And then in the rest of the paper, he says, okay, let's assume this is correct. What are the consequences? And one of the consequences is obviously then the derivation of the famous equation for the photoelectric effect, that the energy of the photoelectron that is emitted in a photoelectric effect scales linearly with the energy of the light that impinges on the photo on the cathode. Right? So this is just a consequence of this beautiful thermodynamic argument. So the paper appeared, and people hated it. So no one bought the argument. Okay, there is the first experiment that was done to confirm the predicted photoelectric effect was by Millikan. So Millikan did this beautiful experiment where he sends light here. Where he sends light on the cathode here and measures then the energy of the electrons that are emitted, and then he plots here as a function of the frequency of the light that is used here the energy of the electrons and confirms the prediction of Einstein from the 1905 paper. And this is what Millikan writes in the paper, in his paper where he confirms the effect. Despite the apparently complete success of the Einstein equation, the physical theory of which it was designed to be the symbolic expression is found so untenable that Einstein himself, I believe, no longer holds to it. But how else can the equation be obtained? So we have a theoretical prediction based on a light quantum hypothesis that is confirmed 12 years after the paper. And actually, Millikan writes, okay, I confirmed the equation, I confirmed that the law is correct, but it's obvious that the theory behind the law is nonsense. So actually, we need to come up with a better way to explain the linear behavior. Yes, there's a question.
Sorry, I know it's probably not your main point, but photoelectric effect actually does not require a photon to be quantum, right?
I come to that. Thank you very much. Yes. This is actually, this was also obviously part of the complaint of the whole thing, right? Because obviously you can explain the photoelectric effect itself just by using classical Maxwell's equations. And this is what people held against Einstein. Yeah? And also this was behind also Millikan's argument, yeah? That basically, look, we confirm the effect, but we don't believe the theory behind it. Yeah? And here's a couple of other statements back then. Okay, Planck, 1909, very, very early on. The rejection of Maxwell's electromagnetic waves seems to me to be a step which, in my opinion, is not yet necessary. Okay? A couple of years later, 1913, Planck, Nernst, and Rubens write a letter of recommendation for Einstein's approval to the Prussian Academy of Sciences. Okay? And they write in this recommendation letter, the fact that he has now and then overshot in his speculations, as, for example, with his light quantum hypothesis, should not be held too strongly against him. Without a certain amount of risk, there cannot be any real innovation, even in the exactest of the natural sciences. So this was 8 years after the paper. Millikan, we already had that. No? Einstein's bold, not to say reckless, light quantum hypothesis flies in the face of the thoroughly established facts of interference. Again, Millikan, a year later. Einstein's equation stands complete and apparently well-tested, but without any visible means of support. Experiment has outrun theory. Or better, guided by erroneous theory, it has discovered relationships which seem to be of the greatest interest and importance, but the reasons for them are as yet not at all understood. Okay? And then, of course, Bohr. Even if Einstein sends me a cable that an irrevocable proof of the physical existence of light quanta has now been found, the message cannot reach me because it has to be transmitted by electromagnetic waves. This was 20 years after the light quantum hypothesis paper. And then the story continued. There were, as we just heard, basically people like Thomson and also Planck and others, they actually made the point that the photoelectric effect we can just explain by using classical Maxwell theory. X-ray interference was a big thing back then. So we had interference phenomena. So this reconciliation was basically impossible in the head of the people. Then came the Compton effect. The Compton effect was a brief breakthrough because it was an effect that required the assumption of conservation of energy and momentum of both the electron and the X-ray photon on the single quanta level. So Bohr tried, together with Kramers and Slater, to come up with a semi-classic explanation. It's the famous BKS theory that sort of failed because it violated some other principles. But for a short moment in time, it was believed that the Compton effect now has actually confirmed Einstein's light quantum hypothesis. So there was quietness for like 10, 20 years, and things seemed to be okay, but people were still uneasy. Schrödinger was strongly promoting to look into semi-classical theories and so on, and it was eventually Chains who came up with a very well worked out semi-classical theory of radiation that described essentially more or less all known effects that you would usually attribute to light quanta, including also atomic phenomena like lamp shift and so on. So things where you would really would require quantum theory of the electromagnetic field. So we were, this is now the late 60s. In the late 60s, we were now in a situation where the question was again there, does the electromagnetic radiation really require a quantum description? So another way of framing the question is, can we have an experiment that has an outcome that cannot be described by semi-classical theory? Okay? So and this is essentially the right question to ask. And this was the question that John Clauser was eventually asking. And so I give you the basic idea. The basic idea is intensity correlation measurements. So in quantum optics, what people have introduced, in optics, what people have introduced are correlation functions, two-point correlation functions in order to characterize the electromagnetic field. You can have two-point correlation functions of the field, so field-field correlation functions in order to quantify coherence. It's the so-called G1 function. And you can have two-point correlation functions in intensity, which would be four-point correlation functions in the field, characterize other properties of the radiation field. And these G2 functions, essentially, one way of doing that is to define them in time. So basically, you measure two-point correlations of intensities of a light source at different times, which would be defined as the time average of an intensity at one time and at a later time. Okay, and then you normalize the whole thing. So you normalize it simply on I of t and I of t plus tau. Okay? If this whole thing here is, and now you focus yourself only, so this is an additional assumption, only on ergodic and stationary processes. So you want to actually know the stationary properties of the field that you investigate, which means that the denominator simply reduces to a simple mean of I square. So that means this thing just looks like now I of tau, I of t plus tau divided by I square. Right? Now, and how is such an experiment done? Well, typically what you do is you just have a source somewhere. So here's your source that emits, let's say, electromagnetic radiation. And the way you could measure now intensity correlation functions is you basically just put a beam splitter here, so a half silver glass plate, whatever, where you have reflection and transmission of the radiation. And in both of the output ports, you put a detector. So this is how I do a detector. This means this is some semiconductor device, and that's a cable. Okay, so this thing can do a click. So I have two detectors now that monitor the intensity. Okay, and what you do is now you correlate the two. So you introduce a time delay between the two, and then you correlate the two. So that's just a logical end. And this is now your detector out. So this is now the correlation output, right? And this is how you measure a two-point correlation function. Intensity, correlation function. Very simple. Okay. So now, look at the following. You can have, instead of now measuring at arbitrary taus, you now measure at tau equals zero, okay? So for tau equals zero, this is G2 of zero. The whole thing is simply the mean of I square divided by the square of the mean, okay? Now, this, just using Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, is always larger or equal than one. By necessity. Okay? So this is simply Cauchy-Schwarz here. That the mean of the square is always larger than the square of the mean. So what you have now is, you have now a condition for any stationary classical source of radiation that you now just average, yeah, basically statistically average, that all two-point correlation functions, so all the G2 at time difference 0 has to be larger or equal than 1. Okay? Now, imagine that your source now emits a single photon. Okay? So a single photon would come to the beam splitter, and it would either be transmitted or it would be reflected. So it would be either detected here or here. Okay? So that means the correlation between the two is 0. So if I have a source now that emits a single photon, then my G2 of 0 is 0. So I have now actually a counterexample for this that violates this bound. So in other words, if I have intensities here that are just given by solutions of Maxwell's equations, where then the intensity is just E square, so the electric field square, then any statistical mixture of radiation that obeys classical Maxwell's equation will always be bounded in the G2 function here by from below by 1. Observing a violation of that is an indication that no semi-classical theory can actually describe that. So in a way, sometimes you find in the literature that G2 of 0 larger than 1 is one of the classicality criteria for statistical properties of radiation. So violating this is a signature of non-classicality of the radiation. And this was the argument that John Clauser made in the late 60s and the early 70s. So he realized that for any theory based on classical waves, there would be a finite amplitude both in the reflected and the transmitted arm, which means that you would always have ear correlations at arbitrary times, and in particular, you would have this bound via the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, and that for single photons, you would not have that. And so here's this famous paper by Clauser in 74, where he performs this experiment. You see experimental distinction between quantum and classical field theoretic predictions for the photoelectric effect. We have measured coincidences between four photomultiplier tubes. So his experiment is a little bit more complicated. He has a source, and instead of having just, and here's the beam splitter, instead of just having one beam splitter, he actually now has a source and then two beam splitters, and then he measures cross correlations between them. But in the end, it's also, again, just the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality that can then be violated. And it turns out that the states emitted by this, actually, this is an atomic source, it's a sodium atom, and it actually emits in a two-photon cascade pairs of photons, and with this non-classical source, you can violate now this Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, and this was the first unambiguous experimental demonstration that a semi-classical theory of radiation is not tenable to describe this experiment. So if you want, it was 70 years after Einstein's light quantum hypothesis that we had the first unambiguous experiment that would actually show that you really require, you need to go beyond just the semi-classical description. And obviously the quantum predictions for the G2 function are of course in agreement with that. And just for completeness, since we're talking about history, there was a beautiful experiment by Granger, Roger, and Aspect a little bit later that basically then just used one beam splitter instead of two. So they also had a two-photon emission, and you see detection of the photon here just acts as a trigger to know that now there's a single photon on the way to this beam splitter, and then you have a very nice ideal situation of what I just showed you, a single photon impinging on a beam splitter and then not being split. And having here, now you see this is now the plot, where they plot the coincidences, so the essentially the G2 function at 0, which is much smaller than 1. This would be the classical bound. Okay. Questions?
about the argument. So how different, like, I understand it's different, but I'm not exactly sure why, is the I1, I2 thing divided by VEV, expectation value, from just saying, I have a detector here, they will not measure the same thing, right? Because this is a 50-50% BIM splitter. In theory, they should measure the same thing all the time. If they don't, that means, you know, I had some quanta that I had to choose where to go, quote unquote.
Ah, no. Because, you see, this whole intensity correlation was originally invented to measure the coherence length in a beam. So basically, you can have intensity fluctuations in a beam, right? And so this measures photon statistics in time. Okay, so imagine you just have a laser. Okay, and you detect now what comes. You have a laser, you shine on a detector, and you plot now the time of arrival of the clicks in your detector that comes from the laser. Okay, so sometimes there's a click, then there's nothing, then click. So there's a you have a temporal statistics of arrival time of photons. Okay, and there are fluctuations, and the point is now that you can have the point is now that if you analyze these fluctuations, so you correlate now numbers of photons that are from one source, one at the same source at different times, okay? And what this statement is saying here is that if I look at the number of photons that arrive at the same time, yeah, basically I just split the source, okay? And I look what happens, then there's always a finite probability that when I measure something here, I will also see something here. Okay? But this is the interpretation of a two-point correlation function. Two-point correlation function just tells you what is the probability that if I measure value I1 at time t, I find the same value at the time I1 t plus tau.
So basically, again, so I could just take I1 minus I2 divided by I1 plus I2. If that thing is non-zero, obviously there's going to be noise, whatever, but if that thing is non-zero and I had a perfect experimental condition, that would prove that this is something with quantum, because otherwise the two detectors should measure the exact same thing the entire time, no? Like, I feel like I'm missing something here. Right? If I have a BIM splitter 50-50 in a classical situation, they will always measure the exact same thing on both ends. It doesn't matter if the laser fluctuated, because it will fluctuate for both of these guys at the same time. But if I take the difference between these two and it's different, then again, obviously BIM splitters are not perfect and whatnot, but in theory, if I calibrate it once, in theory, I take the subtraction, I divide by a sum, this is non-zero, that means I have quantum. No, I feel like this is not true, because otherwise they would have done this, because it seems much simpler. But I don't understand why it's not true, that you can just subtract the two things at the same time, at equal times, and just get something non-zero.
So your question is, can we come up with other classicality criteria, non-classicality criteria, yeah, or classicality criteria?
Yeah, it just seems like a much simpler one, but maybe it's experimentally more.
So what you are saying is just just take the difference. Just take the difference of photocurrents here behind the beam splitters, yeah. Right? This is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And then what would I gain by that?
If it's classical, it should be the same all the time, right? Because it's classical field. It's split half and half by a beam splitter, right? Or you just need to calibrate once for it because it's 45.77 whatever percent. I don't know. Okay.
Right. Exactly. Right.
Accuracy. Yeah. And then if it's non-zero, that means that you have some fluctuation.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
In the quantas.
I see your point. Yeah. You look actually. This is the way how you detect shot noise. And this is experimentally how you detect shot noise fluctuations in a laser beam. Yeah, you compare the sum of the signal with the difference of the signal, and if those two are the same, then you actually have shot noise. And purely classically, of course, it would go to zero. But experimentally, it will never be zero, right? Okay. So this the problem here is for that one, I would say is a more experimental one.
Okay. No,
because there you always have noise in the experiment, and then how do you discriminate?
Okay.
Say again. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. So in the end, you really want a bound. Yeah, if you basically just have an exact value, then experiment always screws you. Go ahead.
So I have another, I think, very basic confusion that is even simpler, which is, like, let me just take a photo detector and let me photodiode or something. Let me shine a laser at it. And then let me turn the brightness of the laser down, you know, dimmer, dimmer, dimmer. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I should start just seeing discrete clicks at mm-hmm. that photodiode. Isn't that alone already an effect of, you know, quantum nature?
No, because the clicks are generated simply by a trigger that is set in your electronics. Yeah, so basically, you generate photoelectrons internally, for example, in a detector. Right, and then you have a photo current, and at some point you say, okay, now my threshold is large enough that I say, okay, now I've detected something. Right.
I see. So the semi-classical picture is, oh, the laser has a much smaller, you know, amplitude that just isn't able to excite one of these clicks. And
exactly. That would be so semi-classically. If you just integrate over long enough time, exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. You just deposit more and more energy by integrating over a longer time. Exactly. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me give you one more example for Cauchy-Schwarz. So this is the one example that we had. I think historically also this was the first time in experimental physics that a Cauchy-Schwarz inequality was actually used as a non-classicality criterion in an experiment. So all of that is essentially, again, you have a source, and then you measure intensity correlations, right, between detection events. Now, there's also another possibility where Cauchy-Schwarz inequality comes into play. Imagine the following. Imagine you now do an experiment where you have dichotomic outcomes. Okay? So let's say you have an experiment where on one side you can have A1, A2, right, which is plus or minus 1. And on the other side, B1 or 2, which is plus or minus 1. Okay? These are the only two things that are allowed. And then what you can actually do is you can compute A1 plus A2, right, times B1 plus A1 minus A2 times B2. And if you look at that, you will immediately see, because they can only be plus or minus 1, that this whole thing can only be plus or minus 2. Okay? It's obvious. It's a simple algebraic relation that holds no matter what. The next thing you can do is you can actually take the modulus of that. Right? Then basically the plus minus vanishes, and then what you can do is you take the expectation value of that. Right? And then you apply the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, because the expectation value of the modulus is always larger or equal than the modulus of the expectation value, right? And if you now compute that, what is in there, you now arrive immediately at the following relation, namely that you now just compute that here. You have now expectation value of A1 B1 plus A2 B1 plus A1 B2 minus A2 B2 as always to be smaller or equal than 2. Yeah, so you apply the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality and arrived at this relation here, which is also known as a Bell inequality. And now the whole thing in that case is now that basically, if you now attribute to A1, B1, so and the expectation value is taken over simply as an ensemble average, yeah, of sets of A's and B's that you accumulate per experimental run. Okay, and now if you associate now this A1's these A's and B's to measurement outcomes, then the fact that you pre-assume that you have sets of A's and B's that are being used for the ensemble average, simply there, independent now of anything you do. This is something that you can associate with a what we call a realism, physical realism assumption, namely that measurement outcomes simply depict properties of a physical system independent of and prior to a measurement the system carries. And if you realize that basically the values of B1 and the B1 is independent of B2 and the value of A1 is independent of A2, you realize locality. So meaning that that the values of B are independent of the values of A, right? Meaning that whenever you perform a measurement here, it cannot influence the outcome here. Then what you have is essentially physical realism plus locality hardwired in this Bell inequality. Right? So, and this is the whole idea of the Bell theorem that you now say, oh, look, I have three statements about the world. Okay? Namely, locality holds. Maybe I just write that down here. Wait. It. So here are my three statements about the world. So number one is locality holds. That means that measurements being performed in space-like separated regions don't affect each other, which for us now simply means that the A's and B's are independent of each other. The second one, physical realism holds, which essentially means it makes sense to have pre-assigned values of A's and B's, or in other words, we assume that a physical system has a specific property that is prior and independent of the measurement and that is reflected by the measurement. Okay? And three, quantum theory is correct. And these three assumptions together, these three statements about the world, they are called, Bell theorem. Because what we can now show is that if this, so we can now devise an experiment. So again, we have a source here. And now we have, let's say, photons again, because we are still in the quantum optics case. We now have here some device, some setting phi A. And here some setting phi B. And out of that, we can have two possible measurements, plus one or minus one, two possible measurement outcomes, plus one or minus one, right? And the point is now, if my source here is, let's say, an entangled source, so let's say if the state of the source can be written as, for example, I write it now in terms of polarization. So let's say we have a polarization entangled state, could also be a spin 1/2 entangled state, whatever. Then you can find measurement settings. So this would be basically settings of polarizers to measure polarization correlations, where the AB, the expectation value of AB, is actually cosine delta phi, and delta phi is now the difference between phi A and phi B in your polarizer settings, okay? And now you see, if this is cosine delta phi, you can find now angles and settings such that this one will be 1 over root 2, this one will be 1 over root 2, this will be 1 over root 2, and this will be minus 1 over root 2. Such that the overall Bell parameter here is 2 root 2, which is, of course, larger than 2, which violates this Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Okay? And This is actually the whole meaning or the whole statement of Bell's theorem that you see, if quantum mechanical predictions are correct, we violate the inequality which assumes the joint validity of 1 and 2. Okay? So Bell's theorem says that 1 or 2 or 1 and 2 are wrong. So we have to give up either locality or we have to give up physical realism in order to be a consistent description of experiments that involve entangled states. Okay? This is the actual meaning of Bell's theorem. Okay? And, well, it turns out that also here, John Clauser was the pioneer. There are many, many experiments. I just show them to show you that these experiments took place. So, for example, this is an experiment by Clauser. Again, two-photon atomic cascade. And here, different polarizer settings then allowed to measure these correlations between the different outcomes. And obviously, in experiment, Bell's inequality was violated. Which means that those experiments cannot be described by the joint assumption of locality and realism, which, by the way, is an independent demonstration of the invalidity of semi-classical theories of radiation. Because semi-classical theories of radiation, you can map onto a local realistic model where basically the wave just carries locally the properties. And the fact that you can violate Bell inequality means that a semi-classical model for the electromagnetic field for those entangled states is simply wrong.
You mean that statement is true only if you do a Bell's inequality test for the photon, right? You're not claiming that a Bell's inequality test for the electron, like the spin 1/2 system.
No. I'm talking about the photon. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay. Good.
Yes.
Right.
Very good. So I think you now you're starting to see where this is going. Okay. I wanted to provide you with some historical examples where we had experiments that could be described by semi-classical theories of radiation, but of course you could equally well have described them by a quantum theory of the electromagnetic field. So both theories basically led to the same experimental predictions, so it was important to come up with an experiment that could test one against the other. Which brings us, of course, to the next obvious question. Does gravity require quantum description? Sorry, here's a question.
Just a question between 1915 and 1970. So what was the, people have did prove that there was a superposition of charge possible, right? And we know that charge create electromagnetic field. So what was the understanding of what happened to the electromagnetic field generated by an object in superposition?
Yeah, that's a good question.
How can you have a classical description of that?
No, you cannot.
Okay, so then, okay.
But this is a static case, right? I mean, this is just the static field. So you could still argue then that maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, but you need to have a picture that, okay.
That's a good question. So the question is, what would chains actually say to a charge in a superposition, right?
Because for gravity, we have that. We know that we have sources of gravity that are in superposition. So then the question is...
Yeah, I wish we would. We don't.
What do you mean?
And we don't have sources in a superposition.
Well, anything which has energy...
And oh, yeah, yeah.
That you can put in superposition.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
I mean, is...
Right, but now this is a question of experiment, of course.
Yeah,
how can
yeah.
we show that we have a superposition?
No, I fully agree.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
Right. But by the way, this is the same for the electron, of course.
So maybe for the electron, what were the experiment that showed that?
No, there was no experiment, I think.
Oh.
I think there was no experiment with at that time with an electron really being in a superposition and then measuring consequences of that on the field level. I don't think there was any experiment. Actually, I'm not even sure if there is. I mean, I'm pretty sure you can reinterpret some of the trapped ion experiments in that direction, but I'm not sure that there is a really a very clear, clean-cut experiment where you have a charge and a superposition and then probe the field configuration. I'm not sure. I think you can interpret most of trapped ion gates and so on in that direction. Was there a question also?
Can't you interpret the Stern-Gerlach experiment like that? As an electron in a superposition of states or in measuring other states and then turning that into an electric magnetic field that you're measuring? Maybe that's an odd example. But definitely that was interpreted at the time as...
But it was neutral atoms, no?
I thought that it was an electron beam. But
say again?
I thought that it was an electron beam.
Yeah. Stern-Gerlach was a silver atom.
Oh.
Silver atoms.
Never mind then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But certainly at that time, there was, so on the electron level, there was no experiment on the charge level. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. But I agree. I mean, if there were, then of course, I also think so. And then you're done. Because then actually, even at that level, just of static fields, you cannot have then Maxwell's equations anymore as the proper description of the field configuration. You do not even need radiation for that. I fully agree. Yes. Which brings us to the second point now. I'm just rephrasing everything now. Well, does gravity require quantum description? And in order to address that question, well, we just ask the very same question again. Can we have an experiment whose outcome cannot be described by semi-classical theory? And that's sort of the remainder of the talk that I want to show you. I know we started late, but the question is, should we really go the full hour? I mean, I can, but you guys must be totally wasted. Should I continue? Okay, good. I just continue. I mean, I'm wasted because I went out with Mina yesterday, but that's a different topic. I think it was, it was not your fault. I want to stretch a point that I think Giorgio made today in the colloquium, and I just give you another quote. Maybe I keep it low level now because it's late, and tomorrow we go full steam. So again, an historic comment. So these questions, whether gravity requires a quantum description, really go back to the 60s, late 50s, when people were very worried about the state of of physics research in gravity. Yeah, because in the late 50s, gravity research was essentially considered more or less a done field, and people believed there's nothing new that come out, and there was even at the time, the editor of the PhysRef was Sam Goudsmit. It is told that he actually considered to putting out an editorial saying that all submissions on gravity theory would be banned from the PhysRef. And John Wheeler sort of learned of that, and he intervened behind the scenes. And one of the other consequences was that they put together a conference at Chapel Hill where they collected basically the leading scientists in gravity research and field theory at the time at Chapel Hill. And in a letter to a donor, so in order to get funding for the conference, Wheeler made the following point, and I think it's such a nice statement, I just want to read it to you. The absence of any paradox or discrepancy in gravitation theory at the human and astronomical levels creates an obligation to apply Einstein's ideas down to smaller and smaller distances. One must check as one goes until one has either a successful extension at very smallest distances or a definite contradiction or paradox that will demand revision. The challenge cannot be evaded. This I find such a beautiful sentence in there. This is basically he goes on, exactly how to proceed as a matter of wisdom, skill, judgment, and a good idea. nobody guarantees to have a good idea, but the De Witts and both Cecile and Bryce De Witt actually organized this this conference and started to set up a center actually for gravitational research at the at Chapel Hill. Have a very some plan of what to do while searching for a good idea. So I really recommend you to go on the internet and get the report from the 1957 Chapel Hill conference. It's online. It's a full transcript of the whole conference. It was recorded back then, and Cecile De Witt transcribed then the recording, and it has now been re-edited and published by the Max Planck Institute for the History of Sciences, and it's a fantastic read. Yeah, in particular, the best parts is when Feynman tries to explain quantum physics to the hardcore gravity people. This is just beautiful. And there were two main questions that were discussed at the conference. I mean, there were many things discussed, but from a more experimental perspective, two questions were in the end of the focus, namely, do gravitational waves exist? And it was actually at that conference where finally, I think, this was not only resolved, but also where the first ideas for gravitational wave detection were developed. So Weber actually was inspired by the conference to create these Weber bars. And the second one, do we require quantum description of gravity? Now, what I wanted to do was originally, there are two approaches we can go now, okay? And I think you guys are more familiar to the first approach, right? So because, of course, one way to go is to say, look, we assume that a quantum theory of gravity exists, and let's now look for the low energy consequences, okay, of this quantum theory of gravity. Because there have to be some signatures at low energies also for tabletop experiments. And essentially, you know that very well. We've been beautiful talks about that with an example of EDM physics, right? I mean, like the looking for the EDM of the electron is basically look in tabletop experiments for consequence of a one of a high energy physics theory. Yeah, so this is the way how to think of possible experiments that you can come up with now also for quantum theories of gravity. And there are a couple of examples. If you're interested, I can show you some of them tomorrow. And otherwise, we just move on to the second part. Namely, the second part is instead of using a working assumption that you do have a quantum theory of gravity, and now you look at possible dynamical consequences at low energies, which, by the way, does not necessarily require gravity measurements. Okay, because typically, just one example. No, but you, if you take Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you extrapolate it down to the Planck length, yeah, then you will run into problem because your momentum uncertainty will become so large that when it couples through the stress energy tensor to the metric is going to curl, you know that all better. You basically create black holes, and the concept of position doesn't make any sense anymore. So in the end, what some people have suggested is to modify it in the Heisenberg uncertainty relation, which leads to modified commutator relations. And that, of course, could modify the dynamics of massive systems. Yeah, in a way that if you are intelligent enough, you can have a high precision measurement in a table of experiment that would probe for such consequences. And the interesting part is that you don't have to be sensitive down to the Planck scale. Right? Like this is the relevant insight that has been created over the last 10, 15 years, that when you look into low energy consequences, even for Planck scale phenomena, you can pick up signatures that are in principle observable in tabletop experiments. Okay. Now, the other possibility is now, of course, let's not assume anything. Let's be agnostic as much as we can and ask the question that we asked before. Are we really sure that gravity requires a quantum description? Well, I am, but still as an sort of, you know, as someone who wants to see things also, I would like to see it. I would like to, exactly in the spirit that I showed you before, I would like to have an experiment whose outcome cannot be described anymore by just assuming GR and quantum theory, okay? And so this is the second approach, and this I would like to explore a little bit with you, okay? Five minutes.
Oh, you have 5 minutes, okay.
No, I don't know. No, I thought this was 5 minutes. Oh, you want to say something? Oh, sorry. I thought you're chairing me out.
No, I'm not chairing you. God forbid, no. So I wanted to ask, what type of theory? So one of the things about you mentioned EDM, so they are an effective theory, and there the higher the scale becomes, and the smaller the effect, and it's very hard to probe effects that go well beyond. Basically, the size of the effect goes like electromagnetic energies of the atom over the scale TeV scale to some power. So now the question is, why should here the expectation is that you have things suppressed by the Planck mass? These are tiny effects.
Yeah, but the Planck mass is huge, right?
No. The Planck mass that you create in the lab with your spheres is completely irrelevant. I mean, in principle, I'm super Planckian by several orders of magnitude, but that doesn't mean I'm probing quantum gravity, right?
Right.
So in what sense, and I'm totally point two, it's fine, but point one, I don't see how it can have a low energy because everything's suppressed by the Planck scale, unless you have a theory of quantum gravity like large extra dimensions at the TeV scale.
Yeah.
That's the only way. But other than that, I don't see how you can have a full QFT description as we know it all the way to the TeV scale without running into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, look, I can spend some time tomorrow on that if you want. Then, huh? Yeah. No, that's fine. No. As I said, so if there's interest, I just include it then tomorrow, okay? The point, I mean, right now, the point I'm saying is if you look at how the, for example, a modified commutator, but of course, it's always, you have specific models, right? That this is always the point. They're all model dependent, right? So if a specific model and you ask the question, how does this specific model of a modified commutator affect your dynamics? For example, it changes the ground state energies, it affects the dynamic of center of mass motion and so on. And you can simply compute it based on a model that you have. And it turns, yeah.
But those effects meaning that I don't know how they can be consistent with QFT. Usually these things
are. Yeah, this I don't know. Yeah.
So that's the part that's.
Yeah. Yeah. This is also why I rather prefer to talk about the second part because I think actually I personally think it's much more interesting. Yeah. I guess the first one is just there exist these approaches. Okay. Full stop. Maybe that's the better way to present it. a very quick summary, basically, of Jason's talk. I think. More or less. Okay, and just making the statement once more that we have these incredibly beautiful experiments out there, all of which probe gravity using quantum systems at a phenomenal level. Yeah, you already heard from Hartmut today about the neutron interferometer experiment, how basically just the Newtonian gravity affects the wave packet of a neutron. I don't go into the details here, which is sort of the predecessor of the atomic fountain experiments that then Jason was telling us about, and that probe now gravitational effects with much more precision and in much more complex settings. So this, the left side was totally covered. The right side, I just briefly want to show you because it's so beautiful, has also already been mentioned. We have optical clocks that can now measure gravitational redshifts, for example. And here, this experiment by the Vineland group back from 2013 or so, this is so beautiful. What you see here is, this is the optical clock built on an optical table. And now they just raise the optical table here. Okay, they just lift it by 30 centimeters in the lab, just lift the whole table, and then they monitor how the clock rate changes when they lift the table. And you see that here, this data here, this was a sensitivity to a 30 centimeter lift of the experiment. Okay? And if you look into the literature, like a couple of months ago, there was a recent paper by Jun Yi's group. They demonstrated now sensitivity down at the millimeter scale, okay, which is just completely amazing. Caveat, I just want to repeat one more time, that these are not all experiments that can be consistently described by what I call a semi-classical treatment, meaning you assume, let's say, in the best case, GR plus QFT. So basically, QFT inner curved spacetime. Of course, I mean, most of the experiments, you don't even have to do that. You can be even much more low level. But the point is, at the best, this is what you can do, and you describe these experiments. Now, let's go back to Chapel Hill. And let's reverse the question. Instead of how do quantum systems react to gravity, now we ask, how does gravity react to quantum systems? Okay? And here, this is a sketch also from the Chapel Hill conference. Feynman gave a Gedanken experiment at that conference. Okay? So basically he said, what about, assume the following, assume that we have now here, this is now a Stern-Gerlach type configuration. Okay? So basically we have a mass, let's say with an internal spin, okay, and we send the mass through some sort of Stern-Gerlach device, okay, which means that afterwards we have now the possibility with this Stern-Gerlach device to prepare the mass in a superposition of being, let's say, here and being here. Okay, so basically what you prepare is now you prepare a state where your source mass is either up, right? So let's call it the source mass. Is either up, right, or down. Okay? And now assume that you have a second mass just sitting here next to it. Yeah, here is now our test mass. Here is our source mass. There's the test mass. And so basically at time t equals zero, you just have now your test mass here at the position x naught. What happens now? If you switch on gravity, so now you let them gravitationally interact, and let's say they just let them just freely fall now, and then they gravitationally interact with each other. Well, then let's say in a very simplistic, naive way of thinking, this test mass here gets accelerated, yeah, towards the source mass, and this acceleration is very simple, just Newtonian, right? It's just a Newtonian acceleration. Which is just a Newton's constant, right, times the source mass divided by r square, right, the distance square. And of course, yeah, now we have two possible distances, right? So either it's this distance or that distance, right, which means you have either here d1 or d2, which means you have two possible accelerations, a1 or a2. So it means what happens now to my test mass here, my test mass will start to branch. Yeah? So basically, there will be one acceleration that, so after some time t now, the upper branch of the source mass will be correlated to a upper branch of the test mass, upper position of the test mass, and the lower branch of the source mass will be correlated with a lower branch of the test mass. Yeah? And, well, obviously, right, if these two states, so xu and xd of our test mass system are more and more orthogonal, yeah, distinguishable, then this state here is entangled. Okay, entangled if this one is the case. Now, again, it's a totally trivial argument, and we all agree that these two masses will become entangled. Right? It's not a big deal. So what? Well, it is a big deal if you want to describe this situation now by only using the principles of GR in quantum theory. Because according to GR, now we are exactly at the argument we had before with the charges. According to GR, we have a classical field theory. Whatever is in this box here will create a fixed metric within which my test mass now just follows a geodesic. Okay? Because a classical field theory can just produce a single metric. So the point is that if I use now the principle of GR, I will have one metric here in which my test mass follows a geodesic, which means that my test mass will never branch and will never become entangled. So any classical field theory will have to predict by necessity that no entanglement will take place. Or in other words, this is an experiment whose outcome you cannot explain anymore by simply assuming GR plus quantum theory. Okay? So, and basically what I wanted to do now for the rest of my 1 hour and 2 minutes is essentially, well, make more sense of that. Put some numbers in and make, so I want to make this now an experimental challenge. Okay? So question is, do I still have 5 minutes or should I stop? It depends on people. So yeah, yeah. Do you want some numbers or should we do this tomorrow? Jesse. Jesse has a question, I think. It's super hard to hear, sorry. Either it's not working or you... I think it's not working. No, it's not working. No.
Take the other one.
Charge one, maybe it's discharged.
Sorry. I can also come up. It's only important that I hear you, no?
Yeah,
Mm-hmm.
And a question about whether, what are we going to learn?
Right.
For example, the Higgs self-coupling, now that we know the Higgs map, description for the Higgs self-coupling, on high luminosity LED, have our data, measure the Higgs self-coupling, the way that we talk about it is artificially create alternate hypothesis by the Higgs self-coupling.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a
right.
I know what I believe.
Yes.
But I don't know how to turn that into. So if you're going to report the results, report it.
Oh, but yeah. Okay, I can. Okay, nice, very nice. Yes, yes, yes.
Experiment to say, this experiment
is making
a better test.
Yes, yes, yes. Very good. Thank you very much. No, that definitely. Basically, let me reformulate what I think I already tried to say. So your question is, how does this establish an hypothesis test? So what hypothesis am I testing? And the statement that I'm trying to make is that such an experiment would be the first example of a phenomenon that you cannot explain anymore by using GR, GR plus quantum theory. Okay? So, and this is, by the way, this hypothesis is like the most fundamental assumption for us in order then to be able to do quantum theories of gravity. So I think the hypothesis that we are testing here is really, can gravity be exclusively described classically, gravity phenomena? This is the hypothesis I think you're testing. Yes? Oh, yeah, oh, very nice. Oh, yeah, so this is something, I hope so, but this is where I really would need help. And because the point is, I mean, you can parameterize gravity, right? So you have the test theories, for example, and the question is, of course, can you have a model landscape of semi-classical theories, and would those parameters somehow be helpful that you could bound? I don't believe so, And the simple reason is that these are low-energy tabletop experiments. So that means everything, so we will all, well, I guess most of us here will expect that what we see in such an experiment will be consistent with a quantum field theoretic description of gravity. Right? And since it's a tabletop experiment, it's like every quantum theory of gravity will converge to one and the same quantum field theoretic description of gravity in the low energy scale. Right? So I would not expect, therefore, that with such an experiment, you will get any guidance whatsoever for the structure of a high energy theory. Is that, yeah? Does it make sense?
It makes sense, in fact, I guess. So oftentimes, instead of models, for example, like talking about the value of W, and say,
I have doubts because it will be consistent, really, with something that I guess even I can write down in that energy regime, which makes it super boring, and even I can write it down. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4. Can you just be loud? It seems the microphone doesn't work. I will repeat the question or the comment. Yeah, right. Yes. Yes. Oh, definitely. It's very interesting that several, I would even claim many, people from the classical GR community, they expect quantum theory to break down in that regime. So. And look, guys, I mean, look, I mean, I can tell you, seriously, is this recorded? So I can tell you, I just essentially come from a meeting with Roger Penrose, who very strongly, no, but, come on, and this is not just one, you know, and so really, believe me, I've talked to people like that. I think we all agree here that this won't be. Yeah, but seriously, there are many people out there who believe that gravity is different. No, this was Rana's point. Yes.
I have 1/r potential.
Yes.
Force, right? In other words, if I make a mirror of this with your electrically charged,
yes,
right? All what I would expect is what's written, except that the strength of the force will be much larger.
I fully agree with that. Yes.
That's it.
No, I fully agree. So yes.
But I agree that discuss what is it that we...
Okay, so let me basically the comment is, look, everything here, yeah, obviously it's a tabletop experiment, can be fully described. I don't need GR for that. Yeah? Basically, this is the statement. Yeah? For most of that, Newton is totally sufficient. Maybe a little bit of post-Newtonian, but that's it. Okay, therefore, for such an experiment, I cannot make any distinction, right? Because I'm not testing actually GR. I fully agree, and I will come back to that tomorrow a little bit later, because So I call that the Dvali levels of excitement. I had some discussions with Gia, and so this here is the zero level of excitement. Then there's the level one excitement is when you do an experiment where you also actually show that the field propagates, that it's not just static. And then level two excitement would be that you actually have access to a field degree of freedom, for example, by adding a clock to the whole thing, okay, where you now have, in addition to having a Marsian superposition, right? So basically, you have here now a clock, okay? Instead of this other quantum system, the clock becomes entangled with the field, right? And then if you trace out the clock, you lose visibility in your superposition, or you lose purity in the superposition because of entanglement of the field degree of freedom with the clock. This would be level two excitement, okay? Because now you really have something where you couple to the field degree of freedom itself. Right? So these would be the three levels. And of course, as an experimentalist, I think one has to be extremely careful what can your experiment say. And this is why I was saying now also when I responded to Jesse, my statement is such an experiment cannot be described by assuming GR, okay, by assuming a field theory plus quantum theory. Such an experiment can be described by just assuming, by just using Newton and quantum theory. Okay, this yes, and then basically Newton. I do not even need a superposition of fields because in Newton I just have instantaneous interaction. Full stop. Okay, so there is no inconsistency. But my point is that this experiment cannot be consistently described if I assume GR. And this is not a weak statement, because obviously I now have then a situation where I can describe the experiment by using just instantaneous Newtonian interaction plus quantum theory, but I cannot describe it consistently starting at the GR level and then linearizing it down consistently. This is not possible. Yes. Oh, it does. It does. If I put a charge in a superposition, the field configuration I get is not a valid solution of Maxwell's equations. Full stop. Maxwell's equations cannot describe a field configuration given by a charge and a superposition. Just doesn't work. It's just that this argument hasn't been made in the optics case because people, could work with radiation instead of with static fields. No, this is what I was saying before. I'm pretty sure that not, but I'm pretty sure that you can interpret most of the current trapped ion experiments in that spirit. But I need to ask Rainer Blatt also. Sorry, again. What gravitates? I don't know. Seriously. So this, I don't know. I'm happy to learn about that, okay? I simply I never thought about that. I'm more than happy to learn about it. I don't have any answer to that right now. Jesse looks like he has an answer.
The question.
Thank you. That's a very nice example. Yes. So this goes back to my number one, right? So basically, this is another possibility. Look for phenomena that would be consequences of a quantum theory of gravity. And I have talked about tabletop experiments, but obviously, you can also look at astrophysical phenomena, right? And so I just saw recently there is for the long-range correlations in the CMB, there is now loop quantum gravity predictions that would sort of, there are anomalies that would be modeled. Definitely. This would be model-dependent observations. Yeah, definitely. No. So this would be of the first type. Okay, so you assume a quantum theory of gravity and you look at the consequences. Yeah, and this is super exciting at the moment. I agree. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah, but there are some long scale fluctuations, right, that basically some people claim can be modeled better by using, you know the papers, right? It's just recent. Yeah, as I said. No, but it's definitely, I mean, I think the message is it's very interesting to also look for astrophysical, cosmological consequences of possible quantum theories of gravity, no doubt.
Yes.
None of us is exhausted, I can see, but the batteries of the microphone on my laptop are. So
yeah. Let's close it. Yeah. Very good.